Good evening, and thank you for joining us tonight for Lambda Legal's Wills of Stake and Proxies Oh My teleconference with Director of Life Planning, Cindy Horn. This conference tonight is part of Lambda Legal's Protect Yourself campaign that we run each year during tax season. Before we start, we'd like to thank the Anita May Rosenstein Foundation, which has graciously helped underwrite the entire Protect Yourself campaign and has been a gracious sponsor of Lambda Legal, especially in regards to our life planning and marriage initiative. Tonight we are joined by Lambda Legal's Director of Life Planning, Cindy Horn. Cindy is new to Lambda Legal, so it's very exciting for all of us to get to introduce you to her. Cindy comes to us with a strong background in family law and estate planning, having been a practicing attorney in Dallas focusing on LGBT issues prior to her joining us in Lambda Legal. In 2000, she was an assistant editor for Black's Law Dictionary. She drafted more than 4,000 entries for a handbook of family law terms. So she is very well versed in life planning issues, and this should be a very interesting call. A few housekeeping items. My name is Matthew Rojas. I'm the director of membership, and I will be moderating tonight's call. We invite our listeners to please submit questions throughout the call if they come up. You can send questions to Liberty Circle. Again, that's libertycircle@lambdalegal.org, and we'll do our best to either answer the question on the call or to respond to you via email. Just one request. We will not be discussing tax issues tonight. We are really going to stick to wills, estates, and proxies, and various other life planning documents. So if you do have a question about taxes, we'll do our best to answer it or direct it to the right person, but it most likely will not be addressed on tonight's call. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Cindy Horn, who I think is going to start with a brief overview of what we're going to talk about tonight, which is wills, estates, and proxies. So Cindy.
Great. Thank you, Matthew, and welcome to this teleconference. I'm so happy to have all of you in attendance. This is a subject that I'm really passionate about, and so I appreciate your interest in it, too. I think it's something that all LGBT people, and truthfully, I believe everyone needs to have this information. So I'm going to try to really hit the high points tonight, and then I will try to – I'll take questions if you have questions, and I will try to answer them. This is please understand that I'm talking to people from a lot of different states, so nothing that I tell you tonight is going to be really state-specific, and I'm not giving you legal advice. I'm just giving you legal information. So I'm going to be talking to you in general about the documents that you need and about the state of life planning as it exists in the LGBT community today. Matthew tells you that I'm not, this is really, the tax questions go beyond the scope of this seminar. I do want to say a couple of things that may answer some questions that I saw beforehand, just very generally. A lot of you are concerned about tax issues and about the marriage issue versus the non-married issue. Unless you have current under the law as it currently stands, unless you have a fairly substantial estate or you are making really large gifts to someone, you probably are not going to be very greatly affected by the tax laws as they are today. Under today's law, for federal estate tax, your estate needs to be more than $5 million, and you can currently give a gift to any individual of $13,000 a year without any sort of gift tax. So that may lessen some of your concerns to know kind of what the income levels that you're looking at before you really start needing to have concerns about estate tax and gift tax. Having said that, those numbers are likely going to change, and in many cases we don't know what those numbers are going to be. So this is a question that you need to address with your own tax attorney or CPA if you have more questions about it than what I've actually covered in this. So mainly tonight I want to talk to you about the documents that I think you need and why I believe you need them. And I believe that these are documents that that everybody needs. And I'm going to talk about a will and why you need a will, but I'm going to do that last because I believe that most people know what a will is. They pretty much know why they need one, and they understand what a will does. It's the other documents that very often people don't know about. So the first document that I recommend for everyone to get is a power of attorney. A power of attorney is a document which allows another person to tend to any of your financial business, buying and selling property, filing your income tax. In many instances, in some states, they can invest money. Anything that you can do with your money or property, the person that you name as your agent under a power of attorney can do. The document can be made effective immediately, or it can be made effective when you, for whatever reason, become incapacitated. And so in my practice, people would always ask me, well, when do I need to do that? It's really a very personal question. Do you really want to give the ability to another person to do anything that you can do financially and with your property while you're still capable of making all those decisions yourself? If it's somebody that you trust completely and want to do that, there's nothing wrong with doing that. But many people make these documents effective when they become incapacitated, so that as long as they're capable of taking care of their business, they don't really see a need to give that power to someone else. But no matter when you do it, you do need to be sure that the person that you are naming is someone that you trust completely to do with your property and finances what you would do and what would be in your best interest. The person that you name as an agent has a very high fiduciary responsibility not to mismanage your money, not to make risky investments, not to do anything that would be detrimental to you financially, but doing something to correct a problem is always worse than doing it right the first time. So in any of these documents, you do need to be sure that the person you are naming is a person that you trust completely. The next document is a medical power of attorney. The medical power of attorney is a document that in most states is only effective when you cannot make medical decisions for yourself. In other words, if you have a son, for example, who's a doctor, and you want to give him your medical power of attorney to make your medical decisions, even though you are perfectly capable of making those decisions yourself, that's not going to be honored. This is a document that says, when I can't make medical decisions for myself, these are the people that I trust to make those decisions for me. Unable to make decisions for yourself can mean a variety of things. It can mean that you're in a coma. It can mean that you have Alzheimer's and you are, or dementia, and will probably never again be competent to make your own medical decisions. Or it could mean that you're in surgery and some emergency arises while you're in surgery and a decision needs to be made about your health care. In which case, while you are under anesthesia, the power would be invoked, and then when you come out of the anesthesia, it would you would then go back to making your own medical decisions. Included in that, you need to put a visitation authorization. Many hospitals, I hate to say this, are doing everything they can to prevent same-sex couples or individual or LGBT individuals from having their partners, their spouses, or friends of theirs visit them in the hospital. So just because you give to someone a medical power of attorney doesn't necessarily mean that those people will be able to visit you in the hospital. So be sure that when you are doing a medical power of attorney, that medical power of attorney includes within it a provision that certain people be allowed to visit you or do a separate document, depending on what your state wants you to do, a separate document that points out that you want certain people to be allowed to visit you while you are in the hospital. You also need to have a living will or an advance directive. A living will, or in some states it's called a living will, in some states it's called an advance directive. This is a document that makes known your wishes should you require life support. Do you want to be put on life support and kept alive no matter what? Do you not want to be put on life support? If under certain conditions, and you can, in most states you can say what those conditions are. You can say if, for this is just for example, you can say if two physicians say that I'm in a comatose state and in all medical possibility I'm never going to come out of that comatose state, then under this situation do not hook me up to life support. This is a document that I really think you should discuss with your primary care physician or some medical person that you trust to find out, explain what you want and get them to help you come up with the words that you can put into a legal document that your attorney is going to prepare for you. In this document, you can also say if you want food and liquids withheld. And in my practice, this was when I initially started asking people if they wanted to do that, many of them were very reluctant to say, no, don't give me, you know, I don't want to be starved to death or I don't want to have fluids withheld. But the longer I practiced, the more people began to change the way they felt about that. However, I'm not advocating that. I'm just telling you that that's something that you can do. If you say that you want artificial nutrition withheld, that's basically a way of hastening your death. If you say, if I'm in such a state that I'm never going to come out of a coma, I'm never going to get well, two doctors have confirmed this, when I get to that point, stop feeding me artificially and just allow me to starve to death. Again, it's a very difficult decision to come to, but it is something that you can do if you're interested in doing that. This document really came about and got a lot of press at the time of the Terri Schiavo case, the woman who was in a coma and was her husband was fighting with her family about whether or not to take her off life support. I think that people need to do this document for a couple of reasons. Primarily, you need to do it because your needs need to be known. People around you need to know what your wishes are. Your physician needs to know what your wishes are. And you, in addition to that, you need to make that decision for yourself rather than putting that burden on a loved one or another family member to make for you. It's a very personal decision, but someone in authority needs to know what your wishes are around having life supports withheld. Another document that a lot of people don't know about is the appointment of an agent to control the disposition of remains. This is a document that lets people know what you want to do, what you want to happen to your body at the time that you die. You can also, in many states, put funeral instructions in that document. So primarily people use the document to say whether they want to be cremated or buried. But when I was practicing, I had a lot of people say a lot of different things to me. They wanted to be buried in the family plot next to Aunt Susie, who they had loved during their lifetime, or they wanted their cousin to have their remains and take them, you know, on top of a mountain and dispose of the remains. If you are a transgendered person, it's probably important to you that your preferred name be put on your tombstone if you have a tombstone. You may have certain wishes about how you're dressed when you die. So all of these are things that you can put into an appointment to of an agent to control the disposition of remains. People very often ask me, can I put this, the language about this in my will? I don't think it's a good idea to put this language in your will. This needs to be a document that's separate from your will. Probably when you die, all of this, your funeral services, your burial, your cremation, all of those things are probably going to have occurred before anyone even cares to look at your will or bothers to look at your will. So if you put instructions about what you want to happen to your body after you die into your will, in many instances, something may have, it's probably already been done before anybody gets around to looking at the document. So I think that you need to do this as a separate document. If you have children, there are some other documents that you need to do. If you're a single person with children, or if you are a same-sex couple and only one of you is a legal parent to your children, or if you are a same-sex couple and both of you are legal parents to your children, in any of those instances, there are documents that you need to provide for what happens to your children when you can no longer care for them, your minor children, when you can no longer care for them. So one of those documents is the nomination of a guardian. This is a document in which you say, if I'm no longer capable of taking care of my minor children, this is the person or these are the persons that I want to be able to take care of my children. That might be your partner. It might be another family member if you don't have a partner, or if something happens to both you and your partner. But this is going to be the person or persons who will care for your children when you can no longer care for them, or if something happens where you can no longer care for them. In many states, if you're naming a couple as the guardian of your child or children, that couple has to be married. I don't know that that's true in all jurisdictions, but I know that in some jurisdictions that is true. So that's one consideration that you need to have when you are naming a guardian of your children. Another consideration, if you just have two friends, for example, and you like both of them and you think both of them would be good guardians for your children, but they're not a married couple, I generally advise my clients to name one first and another one as the successor, because you want somebody to have the power to make decisions. And if for some reason the two people that you nominated as co-guardians, assuming that you were able to do that in the state where you live, if they didn't agree on what should happen, then there's a problem if you've just got two people both having equal power and they can't agree on what should be done. Then I think it's also a good idea for you to have a health care power of attorney for your children in case something happens that you can't make medical decisions for your child. There are a variety of reasons to do this. If you travel, for example, if you travel and you often leave your child with a babysitter or a relative, that person might need to make emergency decisions for your child if you're not there to do it. Again, if you are the legal parent of your child, but your same-sex partner is not the other legal parent, or if you don't have a partner, if you're a single parent, you want somebody to be able to make medical decisions for your child if you can't make medical decisions for your child. So those are the questions, those are the documents other than a will that I'm going to talk about. Matthew, do we have any questions that come in?
We do. Just to kind of take us back to before the discussion about children, we have a couple questions about the various powers of attorney, and I'm going to kind of sum up a couple of the questions as I've seen them, which is obviously throughout our lives, relationships change. Luckily for LGBT people, in a variety of new states, people can get married. How do relationship changes affect who you, say, assigned on a power of attorney or a healthcare proxy, and do those decisions change? So if I get married in my course of my life and my partner is not my power of attorney, but I obviously want them to be, does my marriage override that, or do I need to change that on my documents?
It really, in many instances, it depends on where you live. So that if you are in a state, if you live in a state that recognizes same-sex marriage and you are legally married within that state, then certain rights are going to flow to your spouse in that state. But if you live in a state that does not recognize same-sex marriage, you need the documents. If you live in a state that recognizes same-sex marriage and you get married in that state and you move to a state that doesn't recognize same-sex marriage, even though you are still legally married, the state where you are now residing that does not recognize your marriage is not going to recognize the rights that are extended to a spouse in the state where you married. So you need to get the documents done in that state where you are now living. In addition, although there are now several states that recognize same-sex marriage or where you can marry or that recognize same-sex marriage, for instance, even before New York granted same-sex marriage, New York had already said, we are going to recognize other people who are married, same-sex couples who are married and who are in New York. But if you are traveling in a state that doesn't recognize your marriage, you're going to need these documents if something happens to you. So if you live in, for instance, California, you were married in California when California was recognizing same-sex marriage, you are legally married within that state, but you travel to Texas on vacation, and something happens to one of you, and you need to get health care, you need to have a document that says that your spouse, your legal spouse, has the right to make health care decisions for you. So I know that many people now who are legally married and living in states that recognize their marriage tend to think that these documents aren't as important for them as they once were, but I believe that they are just as important, and in some instances even more important, because you certainly don't want to be legally married in the state where you live and travel to another state or a foreign country that doesn't recognize your relationship and have your spouse not be able to visit you or make medical decisions for you if something happens and you need that. So does that answer your question, Matthew? Is that what you were asking for?
Yeah, and I'm actually just going to quickly ask it in the reverse, which would be does the person on the document override a spouse if you are in a state where your same-sex marriage is recognized? And then I guess my follow-up question to that, how often would you suggest that people sit down and review these types of documents throughout their life?
Okay, in the first instance, I think that in most jurisdictions, if you have executed a document that says this is the person I want to be making decisions for me, that document is going to override. But I think that that varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But if you have a document and the person who's named on that document can come forward and say, look, I'm the person that this person wanted to make decisions for her, I want to make those decisions, I think that in most cases, the state is, whoever you're giving that document to is going to recognize that document. And I say this because let's say we're talking about your parents who are elderly, and neither one of them want the other one to be making medical decisions for them because they're getting older and they don't want the stress of it, and so they've signed a document that says, I want my child to make medical decisions for me, then that child would have the ability over the spouse. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, and what was the second question?
I actually think you answered it.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure. But you actually touched on something that brought us to another question, which is we have a couple who are overseas or are moving overseas, and you sort of touched upon it a little bit to having the documents to protect yourself overseas. How do these documents, and again, I know it's going to vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but how important is it to have these documents built if you are going to become an expat or traveling overseas?
I think that the best thing to do, first of all, let me just go back and say that when you're traveling, you should always take with you a copy of your medical power of attorney, perhaps your power of attorney for business purposes, a copy of your living will, and a copy of your agent to control the disposition of remains. Not the originals, just take a copy with you. Leave your originals wherever you keep them for safekeeping, but let someone that you trust know where the originals are and how to get to the originals. But anytime you're traveling, you need to have, whether you're in your car or on an airplane, if you're on an airplane, you need to have them with you in a bag on the plane in case your suitcase gets lost. But you need to always take these documents with you when you travel so that you have them with you in case you need them, because these documents are primarily emergency documents, and emergencies can happen anywhere. I think if you go to the State Department or to the embassy for the country where you are going to be traveling, you can ask them if there are any certain things that you need to do if you're going to be traveling to whatever country you're going to be traveling to. But you do need to take the documents with you. If you're in a foreign country and you have the documents and you have problems having them honored, you can always go to the American embassy in the country where you're visiting if it's a foreign country.
And we have one follow-up question about the document regarding disposition of remains. Can an individual make provisions for anything other than where to be buried or whether to be buried or cremated?
I've had clients of mine make all manner of decisions on that document. You can write in the documents that I use. I practice law in Texas, and I'm assuming that this is the case in most jurisdictions. You can say, this is the outfit I want to be buried in. I want my ashes put in the cookie jar that's been in the family for a long time. I want these people to be the pallbearers. I want this person to sing at my funeral. It's just a good way to let the people who are left know what your wishes are. Now, if that's not followed and somebody wants to sue on it, you know, you may be buried by the time that happens, but it does, first of all, you need to name somebody that you trust to do what you want them to do, and then tell them specifically what that is that you want. And you can tell them anything you want about where you want to be buried, how you want your body disposed of, and whatever you want to happen at a funeral service.
And how would you vary where people should store what I think you call sort of emergency documents, things you would need in an emergency power of attorney, healthcare proxies, versus other documents, like you mentioned, people may not even get to your will. How should you store those, and should you store them in separate places than you would sort of your long-term documents?
I think that in some instances that's a personal question. A lot of people have a safety deposit box, and they want to keep important documents in that safety deposit box, but that's not the place to put a medical power of attorney that you might need in the middle of the night or on the weekend. If you want to keep your will, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes, we haven't yet talked about the will. If you want to keep your will in a safety deposit box, I think that's fine. You just need to let someone that you trust, probably the person that you've named as the executor, know where the document is, and also make sure that they have the authority to get into that safety deposit box. If your will is in a safety deposit box and you've named your best friend Sally as your executor and you die and Sally is not one of the people that can get into your safety deposit box, Sally can go to the court and ask the court to issue an order allowing her to get into the safety deposit box, but that's a lot of extra work for Sally, and it's going to be extra expense for your estate. And if you had just put Sally as someone who had the right to enter that safety deposit box, then she would have been able to get into it very easily even after you had died. The other documents, I suggest you keep at least a copy of them. In most jurisdictions, a copy of the medical power of attorney, the living will, the agent to control the disposition of remains, in most jurisdictions, a copy of that document is as good as an original. So at least keep copies of those documents where you could get to them in the middle of the night or over the weekend. If you have a safe in your home and you want to keep any of these documents in there, I think that's fine, but you need to let somebody else know where the documents are and how to get to them. You might want to your best friend that you trust, let him or her know what the combination to the safe is or where you keep the key to your safe. Somebody, in case if there were a fire in your home and you and your partner were both in the home and you both were hurt and couldn't get to the documents, somebody else needs to know how to get to those documents for you. At Lambda Legal, when we teach these seminars in person, we have a plastic bag, which we suggest that people use to put their documents in the plastic bag and put inside a freezer. I know that sounds funny at times, but generally a refrigerator or freezer is fireproof. It's a place where you can always find them, and you're constantly reminded that you have them, and when you need them, you remember they're in the freezer in this plastic bag.
Yes, and I will go ahead and plug something about that. We have actually developed at Lambda Legal a tested on airport tarmacs in North Dakota, a bag that is tested to minus 10 degrees Celsius or Fahrenheit, that is durable, that you could put your emergency documents in. We do make that available to our members when you request a Take the Power Toolkit. If anybody's interested in getting one of those, you can always email libertycircle@lambdalegal.org, and we'll certainly reach out to you about sending you one of those bags that would be perfect for your freezer. Just a couple more quick questions that I want to make sure people get it. Cindy, I have a question about the disposition of remains document. Is that what it's called? Is that the proper title?
That's the title that I'm familiar with, and I think if you it may be called different things in different jurisdictions, but if you go to a lawyer in the state where you live and say, I want that document that allows me to say what I want to be done with my remains when I die, the lawyer that you're talking to will know. And I think in most jurisdictions it's called the disposition of remains document.
Okay, and you talked a little bit about the healthcare power of attorney for children. One of our members has a question about, is it possible to create a healthcare power of attorney for a child before the child is born? And they're really thinking about a situation if the partner is delivering and might become incapacitated during or shortly after the delivery. Is this something that's possible?
That's a very good question, and I had it asked to me very often in my practice for that very reason. And generally what I would do is, I'm not sure that the document is legally valid before the child is born, but I also think it's always better to be safe than sorry. So I would do a document just like that, giving the healthcare power of attorney to the person's partner or spouse, and I would say this: I'm executing this document before the child is born in case something happens to the mother during the birthing process, and then I would caution the parent that once the child was born, they needed to come back in my office and get an updated version after the child was born. But that's a very good question, and I think that most people, that's something that they ought to consider doing, because unfortunately that sort of thing does happen from time to time. And you would want somebody to be able to make immediate decisions for the health of the child if something happened to the mother during birth.
Okay, and then I have one more question about powers of attorney and these kind of documents, and then we can move on to wills and estates. And this might just be one of those questions you asked as personal preference, but one of our members wants to know, you explained a little bit about the durable powers of attorney being either effective immediately upon signing or what is called springing only after written finding of incapacity. The member wants to know, in your experience, in terms of getting a doctor to quickly attest to the principle of incapacity, do you find that this is prompt with regard to pressing financial matters, or do you prefer effective upon signing?
As a personal preference only, and not for any necessarily for any legal reason, I prefer that it's effective upon a person's incapacity. I know other lawyers who disagree with me for the very reason that it's not always easy to get a doctor to write something that says that a person is incapable of making their own decisions quickly. So if you have a primary care physician that you've been seeing for a long time, you and your partner both see that doctor, you've talked to that doctor about not only about your own health but about your need to make decisions for your partner or somebody that wants you to make decisions for them, then, you can probably feel fairly comfortable that doctor would get in a hurry and write a letter for you substantiating that the person is incapable of making medical decisions for themselves. Is incapable of tending to their own finances. But it really depends on how comfortable you feel that you could get a doctor to write that letter for you in kind of in case of an emergency.
Okay. Well, I think we can move on from these kinds of documents and talk about some other types. So.
Okay. Well, let's talk about a will. I believe everyone needs a will. There are other ways that people can convey their property. Most but not all states will allow you to have to hold title to property with joint tenancy with a right of survivorship, which means that let's say that you and your partner buy a home together and you each own that home half and half, whether you're married or not, and you own it as joint tenants with a right of survivorship, then when one of you dies, that property automatically transfers to the other person who is a co-owner of that home. In most states, you can do that with a bank account. You can own it as joint tenants with right of survivorship, or you can provide that certain bank account immediately transfer upon your death to somebody who may not even be a co-owner of that account with you when you die. This is not true in every state, but most states allow you to hold property like this. So you need to go to your bank, find out how you can title your bank accounts to so that funds transfer more easily to someone when you die. If you buy real property, if you buy a home and you own it in co-tenancy with someone else, you need to have it titled so that it's has a right of survivorship. Unfortunately, I can't tell you that every state and every title company is going to do that for you. I bought a home with a former partner of mine and in Texas, and we told the title company we want to own this as joint tenants with right of survivorship. Here's the language of how to do it. Here's the law which says you can do it this way. And the title company just refused to title our property that way. But we were down to the wire and we couldn't do anything else, so we executed a subsequent document. But if you're able to hold property as joint tenants, it makes passing that property upon your death that much easier and that much quicker for you. But I still believe that everybody needs a will. No matter how much or how little property you have, when you die, you are going to own things. You're going to own probably a vehicle. You're going to own the contents of your home. And those things need to pass to someone, and they need to pass to the person or persons that you want them to pass. If you live in a jurisdiction that does not recognize your marriage, even though you have a valid marriage somewhere, then the person to whom you are married will be a legal stranger to you, and property that you own will not pass to that person. It'll pass to another family member. Even if you're not married, you're probably going to own things that you want to go to certain people, which may not be the persons who would inherit from you under the laws of intestacy in a state where you live. So if you've got, you own a Monet painting and you want your cousin to get that, you need a will that says that's where that Monet painting goes. If you've got, you own your grandfather's pocket watch and you want to make sure that your nephew gets that because he was close to your grandfather, you need that in a document that says who's going to get that particular piece of property that you own. And just as important is naming the person who will be your executor. I used to have people come and say, I don't want to make my friends mad. I don't know which one of them I want to name as my executor because I don't want one of them to think I'm favoring one over the other. It's a job. Being an executor is a job, and there's a lot of work that needs to be done in most instances if you are someone's executor. So think very carefully about who you want to name as your executor, someone that you trust, someone that you know is competent to take care of business matters, and someone that will do what you want them to do and do it efficiently. So you're naming an executor and you're disposing of your property. A will does both of those things.
As far as the executor goes, Cindy, we have a question. Can you name more than one, and can you sort of name a backup, or should you name a backup?
Absolutely. You can and you should. you should always say, normally if you are in a committed relationship, whether you're married or not, you name your partner as the first executor, but the partner will become your executor when you die, and the partner has probably named the now deceased person as his or her executor, and so there needs to be, the surviving partner now needs to have a will that says who their executor will be. And there's no need to have to go back and redo a document just because one of you has died. I always told my clients, you need to give me at least two people that you trust to serve as your executor or your trustee or the agent under these other documents that we've talked about. And if you can think of three people, let's put three people to serve in succession. That way, you're fairly certain that when the document needs to be used, either where you're naming an agent in the documents that we discussed earlier or in your will, you have named the person or the persons that you want to serve and the order in which you want them to be able to serve.
And I assume with all these documents and with all these people you're choosing in your life, you should notify them in advance and maybe even give them a copy of the document in question.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up because that's something that I had forgotten to say. Always ask somebody before you name them if they're willing to serve. And generally, I think that you should give copies of the documents in which you name an agent to the first person on your list, and maybe to the first and second person on your list. It's not always necessary to give somebody a copy of your will. Just let them, but make sure that they're willing to serve. And that brings me back to the question that you asked earlier that we didn't talk about, which was now I've forgotten what it was. Well, I'll come back. It'll come to me in a minute. But yes, always name people more than one person so that you've got. Make sure that if something happens to one of the people, or somebody could decide that they don't want to serve. So name several people, two or three, and be sure to ask them beforehand.
Okay. And for all these documents, where can people get access to these? Does Lambda Legal provide them? Some people want to know. And is this something that we do? I know the answer to this, but I'm going to let Cindy.
Lambda Legal is not a law office. We don't do these documents. We don't provide these documents to you. I always recommend that people see a lawyer in a state where they live. I know that there are documents that you can buy on the internet or at Home Depot or at the grocery store, but I don't recommend doing that. I think, for one thing, and this is something that we haven't talked about, it's not only the wording of the document that's important, but it's also the execution of the document. Different states have different requirements for the way the documents are executed. Most states generally require that you have two witnesses. Most states require that the witnesses sign in front of the person whose document it is and in front of each other, and that the signatures are notarized. Most jurisdictions do that. But there are going to be a few states that may require three witnesses. Some states may want your witnesses to be at least 18. Some may want them to be at least 16. Some may want them to be 21. So it's not only do you have a document in which the words are what need to be in the document in order to make it valid in the state where you live, but it's also have you executed these documents in a way that the state will recognize, that courts will recognize, that that hospitals will recognize.
And while we do not provide that service at Lambda Legal, we do maintain a cooperating attorney network. Again, to be very clear, these are not people we recommend or whatever. They're just individual lawyers in various jurisdictions who've told us that they specialize in a variety of different fields, and you can always call one of Land Legal's offices or visit our website and ask that question, and they can usually put you in touch with give you two or three names of individuals who are on that cooperating attorney network.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. That was something that I meant to point out. I know also that people ask me, do I need to put things in a trust? Do I not need to put things in a trust? There are a lot of issues that go into making that decision. If you are providing for minor children, you do need to put any gifts that would go to minor children into trust because you, number one, minor children can't own property. They can't inherit money or property from you. And number two, you want to be sure that you are naming someone as the trustee that you trust to take care of that whatever you're leaving to a child. And however, if you're leaving your property to an adult, there are some states, for instance, California, that have very onerous probate procedures, and people try to avoid probate at all costs in some jurisdictions. It really depends on where you live, what's going to be best for you, which is another reason that it's important for you to talk to a lawyer in the jurisdiction where you live to find out if the lawyer says it's really better to put all your assets into a trust, or if, for instance, in Texas, the probate process was really very easy, and so there was no it was not onerous, it was not expensive, it wasn't hard to do. So there was really not a huge reason for trying to avoid probate. So that's not something that I can give a yes or no answer to one way or the other, but that's a reason that you need to see a lawyer. And I wanted to go back and say people also would ask me sometimes, do I need to name the same people as my agents on every one of these documents in the same order? And the answer to that question is no. Let's say you have a partner and you want to name your partner as your first agent on every document that you do. But then you have a brother who's a doctor and a sister who's a tax attorney. You may want to put your brother as the second agent on your medical power of attorney and your sister as the second agent on your durable power of attorney. So, no, you don't have to name the same people in the same order on all those documents.
Okay, well, I'm just seeing that if you have any additional questions about wills or estates or anything. And Cindy, have you touched on everything you wanted to talk to about tonight?
Let me just look and see if I got any questions that came in while we were talking. Give me just a second.
And again, if you leave the call tonight and you have an additional question after speaking with someone, please feel free to email the question to libertycircle@lambdalegal.org. We will certainly do our best to forward your question on or have Cindy send you what she can via email. I also like to let people know who might join the call a little bit late. We will be posting this as an MP3 and a WAV file at www.lambdalegal.org/protect-yourself. Protect yourself, that's /protect yourself. It's where you register for tonight's call. And just while Cindy's sort of looking, just kind of a reminder that we do have more of a campaign going on. If anybody is in New Jersey, on March 17th, we'll be having a tax preparation teleconference geared particularly for same-sex couples in New Jersey. And on March 29th, we will be doing a special care planning for older LGBT and HIV-positive adults teleconference with our staff attorney, Natalie Chin, and cooperating attorney from SAGE. So, Cindy.
That's all for me. I just want to once again thank our listeners for joining the call tonight. If you have any follow-up questions that you'd like to ask me, or if I didn't get to your questions, if you want to email me, those questions will come to me or I can pass them along to someone else. Thank you for your interest in this subject. We've come a long way. We've made a lot of strides. February was a great month in the LGBT community as far as relationship recognition is concerned, but we still have a lot to do to protect ourselves to make sure that wherever we are, our relationships are protected.
And just a special offer for everyone who hung to the end of the call, if you send us an email at libertycircle@lambdalegal.org, give us your address and your name, we will send you over one of those durable plastic bags so you can put your emergency documents in the freezer along with our Take the Power Tools for Life and Financial Planning. So if you're still on the call and you want that bag, just send us an email at libertycircle@lambdalegal.org. Thanks again for joining us, and thank you again to the Nita May Rosenstein Foundation for underwriting this call and our Protect Yourself campaign. Good night.